close. Another pause, and I can feel the weight behind it. She says,
No, we weren't. We've had a strained relationship for a long time. I could tell she agreed to go spy on the bankers only because it was her sister who asked her to do so. She wanted to impress me, to please me, and I knew she would react that way.
So she went to the nightclub
that evening, and just like I'd hoped, she met a group of wealthy men who'd flown in that day. They said they were looking to buy hotels and restaurants around Bucharest.
Where were they from? She replies immediately.
The head of the group, the one in charge, he was American. He told her his name was Tom, and he had her sit next to him at his table. He came on to Roxana that night, but she played cool, rejected his advances. She called me at 4 a.m., said she'd agreed to meet him the next night at a restaurant with a girlfriend of hers. She didn't know if she should go. She worried about how far this could lead.
A pause.
But I encouraged her. I wanted names, specifics.
I point out the obvious now. She was your agent. You were her handler. Talissa sounds like she's about to break down now.
Exactly.
This was bad. Worse than I'd expected. Keep going.
The second night after dinner, they went to a club again, and again he tried to get her to come back to his room. She resisted, although she admitted he was very charming. She also told me Tom met with gangsters from a local group known as the Klanu, or Clan. She said she'd seen them around in discos before, so she knew who they were. She was worried about this, and about the fact that Tom had gotten more aggressive with her. But I talked her into seeing him one more time. Everything she told me he said, none of it helped me pinpoint anything tangible. A few details about his home and family is all. I knew this man was from the West Coast, that he had a family, that he had worked with the local mafia in Romania in some capacity. I needed photographs, names. I needed something to help the case I was working on. So Roxana did what I asked, and she met him the third night in his hotel room.
I put my head in my hands on the darkened roof. Clearly Talissa's drive in all this, despite her lack of experience and her abject terror about what she is doing, stems from deep, unwavering guilt about all but handing her sister over to some powerful and evil men. She seems to sense what I am thinking, and she only confirms it when she says,
I don't know how to run an agent. I don't know how to do any type of criminal investigation that doesn't involve spreadsheets. I sent her into danger over and over. But I didn't know it was dangerous. I swear to you, I didn't know.
She feels bad enough, so I don't draw the connection that she's probably gotten her sister killed. But she's been thinking it, thinking about nothing else. That much has been clear all along. I let her sob a moment without replying. Finally, I say, And you still didn't find out who he was?
No. She didn't get me any pictures for facial recognition. She said his bodyguard was always close and always looking. She wasn't trained for this either. It's not her fault. But I was hard on her. I knew how much my approval meant to her. And I used that to my advantage. She didn't sleep with him, even after three nights, and he became more aggressive. She sensed a growing anger welling in him.
What did this guy look like?
About 45 or 50 years old. Tom was bald, short, very sure of himself. She liked him at first. Found herself being sucked in by his personality.
He sounds like a douche.
A what?
Never mind. What about others with him?
She told me about two men who were always by Tom's side. One was American, late 30s. He was the bodyguard, and she heard Tom call him Sean. She thought he was nice, and she thought Tom treated him badly.
I'm picturing an ex-military man being ordered around by a rich, bossy little runt.
But the one who scared her most, much more than Tom, was a South African. They called him John? I don't know if that was his real name or not. She said he looked at her with eyes of pure evil.
But still, you told her to go back and see them again.
No, not after the third night. It was getting too much, even for me. The gangsters, the aggressive behavior of Tom, the unease Roxana felt from John. On that fourth day, I recognized this wasn't just about bankers with ties to organized crime. I began to suspect that this American who called himself Tom was the leader of an organized crime concern himself. But even then, I had no clue whatsoever that they were sex traffickers.
She cries a moment.
Roxana decided to go back on her own. By now, I guess she felt bad she hadn't given me what I asked for. So, she took the risk.
What happened when she went back? After a heavy, wet sniff, she says.
She told me he tried to rape her in his hotel room, but she got away. Raced past his bodyguard outside the door and made it through the lobby. I flew to Bucharest that afternoon. Her face and arms were bruised, and she was terrified. I went personally to the police, but they did nothing. I went to the hotel, but the American had left. Roxana didn't want anything else to do with me or my investigation, and I couldn't blame her. She wouldn't talk to me.
And then she disappeared.
4 weeks later, she went out to a club, a different club, with some girlfriends. They said she started acting strange, very tired, like she was drugged. They put her in a cab to send her back to her flat, but she never arrived. The cab was found burning under a bridge. There was no one in sight.
Jesus Christ, I mutter.
Harry, either she is still alive, which means I can't rest until I find her, or she is not alive, which means it doesn't matter what I do.
Of course it does. You want to bring her killers to justice, right?
Yes,
she says, but it's not very convincing. What is it?
This is my fault. If she is dead, I will die too.
She isn't speaking metaphorically. I can hear that in her voice. I say, I don't need a partner with a death wish. The sobs continue for a time, and then she says,
I understand. I'm okay. I must see this through.
I think a moment about my own actions, then say, I've learned something in my years doing what I do. If you don't feel guilt, then you can't change. Guilt can be a driving force for good, for doing what's right. Or it can be a limiting force, something that causes you to throw away right and wrong, to justify yourself. That's the weak way to deal with your conscience. The determining factor in whether guilt locks you into evil or spurs you on towards good is your own inner strength, your own moral compass.
What are you saying?
I'm saying you fucked up. Bad. But you've come all this way because you are strong enough to admit it and strong enough to try to rectify your mistake. That's all anyone can ask of you now. I add, I fucked up before. I've gotten people killed. People who didn't deserve it. It never goes away. But I tell myself the only thing I can do is to help others.
That's why you are here.
I guess you and I have similar motivations. She sobs yet again, but her voice regains some strength.
I am okay, Harry. I will do this.
I understand so much now. What I saw as an almost childlike fear in Talissa was, in part at least, an incredible dread about what she would find. A scared young woman who simultaneously wants to pay penance for what she's done. and I see her for what she is now. Dangerous. Minutes later, I sense fresh trouble. Movement in the dark, down a long passage that runs up from the center of the old town, hundreds of ancient stone steps, past dozens and dozens of doorways leading to private residences, raised porches lined with potted plants. At first, I can only tell I'm observing a group of individuals, but as they pass into one of the two sparsely placed streetlights, the orange glow reveals a half dozen men, dressed differently than the ones I saw earlier. Whereas the other men looked more tactical in nature, this group looks like a tiny gang of soccer hooligans. I see dark clothing, facial hair on some, longer hair on others. Again, I use the app on my phone to check the cameras I've hidden in the stairwells and passages I can't see from here. Everything seems quiet other than the men moving straight up the middle. But even though I don't see others on my cams, I wonder if there are more around. The men close on my position with confidence, climbing stairs through the night as one. They are cohesive, an organized unit, each man comfortable that the other has his back. The men's hands are empty, but that means nothing. They'll have weapons. I work with just a few operating principles, but one of them is ironclad. Every motherfucker I come in contact with has a weapon. I speak softly, careful not to show any anxiety now, though I'm feeling a ton of it. Talissa? I guess I failed because her own voice changes suddenly. Apparently she can sense the change of gravity in mine.
Yes, yes, I'm here. What's wrong?
It's showtime. I've got men approaching and they fit the mold. They're about 2 minutes from us at their current pace.
Oh my God, what do I do?
Her voice cracks as she speaks. First, stay calm. I've got everything under control. This is a lie. I'd only really have control of the situation if I were up here on the roof in a sandbag position with an M60 belt-fed machine gun. But I tell myself that showing confidence I don't have is for her own good. Quickly, I move in a low crouch along the angled tile roof to the west side of the building, out of the view of the men approaching from the north. While doing so, I say, I need you to go to your window and open it. I grab the rope and step up on the ledge. Rappelling down quickly, I arrive at her window in just seconds. She is just now opening it, her purse and a backpack over her shoulder. Our comms channel is still open, but we are 5 feet away so she can hear me through her earpiece and in person. Come to me. Grab me around the neck. She moves closer, but she looks down and then backs up a little. It's only about 30 feet to the cobblestones, which isn't that far, but it's plenty far enough to kill her if she fell. I urge her on. You're fine. Come on. She comes closer again, but she doesn't put her foot up on the windowsill, and it's going to be impossible for me to haul her out while holding the rope. Work with me, Talissa.
I can't, I'm...
Really bad dudes will be coming through that door behind you in 1 minute. You want to take your chances with me or with them? She looks back to the door, makes no move towards me, and she's just out of reach. I'm straining on the rope as it is. I try a joke. You're hurting my feelings. But she looks at me, then back at the door. She has a fear of heights, which is not unreasonable, but I also sense that she has a fear of me. I get that too, I guess. She's nearly panic-stricken now.
I can't do this. I'll meet you downstairs. I'll find a way back out. I'll hurry.
There's no time for that. Trust me. Just step up and... But she's already turning away and rushing to the door of her room. Son of a bitch. I quickly rappel down towards the passageway on the west side of her building, and while doing so, I try to come up with a new plan. I've got to work with the situation before me, because my original scheme is up in smoke. Fortunately, I have a rich history of shit going wrong for me to fall back on. I speak softly for the mic in my earpiece, not wanting my words to carry in the narrow passage. Run down the stairs to the ground floor and find a window as far away from the main entrance as possible. Do not go out into the courtyard, because you'll walk right into them if you do. I don't know for sure that they won't send men around the back or sides of the building. I would. But I do know for sure they'll send men straight up the middle, because I saw them advancing up the stairs without any defensive tactical posture. I could see it in their walk, in the way they moved. These guys aren't worried about shit.
Okay,
she says. I'll come around back to meet you.
Yes,
she says again, and I hear nothing but stress in her voice. Once on the ground, I release the line, pull off my gloves, and jam them in my pack. I start moving towards the rear of the building and keep trying to calm her. You're fine. Just get out of there.
I'm in the kitchen. The window opens. I'm climbing out now.
Okay, keep quiet. I near the building's edge at a silent run, my hand brushing the stone of the wall as I slow to look around. I haven't drawn my weapon and hope I don't have to. A single gunshot in these narrow stone corridors would bring every bad guy down on me in seconds. And even though I have a silencer in my pack, the report of a suppressed Glock 19 fire is still louder than a snare drum at a heavy metal concert. I want to maintain stealth, but how the next few minutes go down is not up to me. Instead, it's up to the Romanian woman I've tied myself to in this op, and the assholes coming to get her. Just before I peer around the corner, I hear noise in the back passageway, the scuffle of footsteps on stone. I whisper, "Move quietly. I can hear you running from here." But Talissa's reply in my ear causes me to stop in my tracks.
"Just climbing out the window now."
And this is bad news, because it tells me there is someone else running behind the building. "Wait," I say, but I can hear the sounds of her climbing out the window, both over my earpiece and through the echoing of her movements along the passages. I look around the corner, and I see two men in black tracksuits running on the cobblestones, and they see Talissa as she finishes climbing out of the window. They charge towards her before she even turns to face them. I pull my pistol and whisper for the transmitter in my ear. "Run to your left. Go, go, go." But the men are on her in seconds. She screams as they tackle her to the stones, her voice simultaneously loud in my ear and echoing all around me. I am only 50 feet away, but I don't have a shot from here because I can't be sure my 9mm rounds won't overpenetrate the bad guys and hit the woman. I decide to remain stealthy, to try to get to them before they see me so I can stick my knife into their ribs. But to my right, I hear racing footsteps running in my direction along the eastern wall of the building. Shit. The men holding Talissa down pull her up to her feet. They clearly are not about to assassinate her, so I turn away from the Europol analyst and her captors and climb a narrow stairwell that leads up to a locked metal gate in the wall surrounding the entire old town. Kneeling in the darkness, I see two men run past in the direction of Talissa, and I know that the opposition, whoever the hell they are, has her now. Softly, I speak to her through our communications link. "Stay calm, Talissa. Don't say a word. I'll get you back. Try to keep your hair over your earpiece so they don't see it." In my gut, I feel wrenching pain as I realize that the girl I used for bait is now in mortal danger, and, just like with the women in the cellar, it's all my motherfucking fault. 20. Talissa Corbu was yanked to her feet by the two men, and two more arrived a few seconds later. She tried to scream for help, but a hand slammed over her mouth and nose. A man with a thick accent leaned into her ear.
"We kill you if you make sound, understand?"
Tears rained from her eyes as she nodded, and the hand came away. All four had hold of her body now. Her arms were gripped tightly. A man behind grabbed the collar of her raincoat, and a fourth person manhandled her while ripping off the backpack and her shoulder bag, and feeling into every pocket of her clothing. She heard Harry speak to her softly, and she turned around to look for him, but all she saw were two more men arriving at her position and helping the others. All the goons had dark hair, most had beards, and they wore dark clothing. One spoke into his mobile phone, but he stepped away from her to do so, and she couldn't make out the language. There were smiles among the men, so proud they were that they'd captured her. Soon they began pushing her forward, turning away from the wall at the eastern side of the old town, and heading on foot down the first of many long stone staircase passageways that led down to the stratum. Talissa was in the middle of the group, and though she mostly kept her head down out of abject terror, she did look off to her left and right and regard the faces around her. These were cold, hard men. They weren't police. They were gangsters, and she took them for Turks or perhaps Albanians, but she had no way of knowing until she heard them speak again. As a Romanian, she knew a few Albanians and a few Turks, and although she couldn't speak either language, she could quickly identify it. Her mind began racing. She came to the quick conclusion that there was no way the consortium would have sent Albanians or Turks to kidnap her out of her hotel room in Croatia, unless they had something awful in store for her. She wasn't going to be driven to the edge of town and given a warning. She was certain they were taking her someplace to torture her for information, and then to kill her. And wherever the hell Harry had run to, his promises to protect her rang hollow now. Still, she didn't blame him. She'd panicked at the window, a lifelong fear of heights, a fear of most everything that had to do with danger was to blame. If she'd just trusted the American, she wouldn't be moments away from death now. Her teeth chattered and her mind raced, and she fought a wave of nausea as she continued down the steps. I'm hauling ass 2 blocks and 2 passageways to the left of and parallel to where Talissa and the men in black are descending. I had to wait for them to pass by my position before running here to the east, behind Talissa's building, past the window she climbed out of, and then I turned to my right to begin my own descent. Now I'm 30 or 40 seconds behind the group, but I feel sure I'm making up for it with my speed. As I run, I speak again to Talissa, still softly, because this medieval neighborhood feels like one damn echo chamber. Walk as slowly as you can. You have to slow them down. I hear her speak to the men around her in English, her voice halting.
Please, slow down. I can't walk this fast.
A man snaps at her in a heavy accent.
No talking. Walk faster.
I hurt my ankle when you knocked me down.
I can hear frustration in the man's voice now as he speaks to the others in a foreign tongue that I think may be Albanian. When Talissa says,
Thank you,
I know they are complying with her request and slowing. I run faster. At each little narrow intersection, I glance to my right, hoping to see the group so I know I am getting in front of them. I'm having a hard time coming up with a cogent plan, but I'm definitely preparing for a confrontation. Taking on 8 goons at the same time in an outdoor stone stairwell barely 8 feet across seems like a bad course of action. But I don't know that I have any choice. I consider letting them just take her and then following them to see where they go. But I see the flaw in that plan. If I lose Talissa, then she's dead. If the consortium runs the chief of police of this town, if they have the juice to get a bevy of cops for a surveillance operation, then I don't see why they would pull the cops and send in an Albanian gang to grab the woman if they plan on simply interrogating her and intimidating her. No. They could have used dirty cops for that. The fact that they didn't kill her immediately tells me they need to take her to a secondary location, perhaps with plans to torture information out of her. And the fact that they brought in a foreign criminal gang to snatch her tells me they plan on killing her. Either way, right now, I'm Talissa Corbu's only hope. Just as I sprint through the next intersection, doing my best to stay as far away from the street lamps as possible, I gaze to my right again, expecting another narrow east-west street. But instead, I see I've run out into the northwestern edge of a large triangle-shaped open-air area, 2 blocks wide. The entourage is just entering the square on the northeastern side, and though I'm 40 yards away, in low light, and in front of them, there is no way they can miss a man running at top speed. I hear immediate shouts, both echoing around me and through my earpiece from Talissa's microphone, and just as I disappear from their view, I see 2 of the 8 men peel off and come my way. They are a minute out if they move along the square at a careful pace, but less than half that if they run. I figure they'll run, because they won't know for sure if I'm with Talissa and won't immediately move in a defensive posture. They find me curious enough to send a couple guys to check, and I'm sure someone has told them to be on the lookout for a lone male operator in all this, but they aren't going to just open fire. I don't think. And I won't open fire on them. I have no qualms about killing a couple of kidnappers, but I want to avoid a direct confrontation if possible, while there are so many guns around the girl. At the same time, however, I don't want to go into full retreat, where I'll likely lose my chance to get her back. Looking towards the sky, as I run to the north, I make my decision. I'm going up. To my left, a copper drain spout climbs the side of a three-story building all the way to the roof. I adjust my backpack and start heading up, moving as quickly as possible, hoping like hell I can get over the lip of the tiled roof before the two Albanians make it onto my little stairway passage. For a brief moment, I consider pulling my pistol and firing a couple of rounds into the cobblestones to slow their approach, but instead, I just concentrate on climbing as fast as I can. My knuckles scrape against the ancient walls behind the drainpipe as I struggle for handholds, and the toes of my boots dig for purchase as I climb. Quickly, I realize I'm not going to make it all the way before the men arrive below me, but I choose a pipe out of the illumination of the street lamps, so I do have another way to remain undetected. On the second floor, I swing away from the pipe and step out onto the ledge of a darkened window. I squat down, positioning my body totally within the window's frame, next to a planter with a small orange tree in it, and then I freeze. Below me, two men run into view, pistols swinging low in their hands, and they continue down the 8-foot-wide staircase toward the main street of the old town, still several blocks away. Since I'm in my black clothing and squatting in front of the black window 20 feet above their heads and in dim light, they don't see me. Once they travel another block down, I reach back out to the drainpipe, carefully take hold, and swing my body off the window ledge. Quickly, I continue my ascent up to the roof. Getting up the overhang is tricky, but the drain pipe helps as I dangle off it and climb out, hand over hand, until I can pull myself up onto the tiles. The building I've chosen is on the opposite side of the street from Talissa and her captors, and this puts me farther away from her, with two narrow north-south passages between us. I run along the angled roof and see that there is one more connected building before the next east-west street, so I leap down to it, its roof a few feet lower than the one I climbed onto. Rushing again through the dark, I tell myself I can make the leap across the narrow valley to the next roof, one story lower because it's farther down the hill that descends to the center of the old town. I pick up my pace, pull my backpack off my back, and swing it in my arm as hard as I can. I let it go, and it flies through the air in front of me over the street. While it sails on, I time my footfall so that my last one will land right at the roof's edge, and then I leap, giving it everything I have. I sail over clotheslines full of drying laundry, my feet and arms flailing. I make it over the narrow street and land tumbling onto the roof, using my forward momentum to keep from rolling off the steep tiles. The Glock on my hip bites into me when I bang it on the hard surface, but I'm up on my feet with the momentum of my roll, and I lean down and snatch my pack as I climb, sliding it over my shoulders. I'm well behind Talissa and the others now, still 2 blocks west of me, and I don't yet have a plan as to what I'll do if I manage to catch up. But I keep going. If I don't reach her before they get her piled into a van and out of here, or I don't get to my vehicle to tail them, then I won't get another chance. Almost out of breath, I speak softly for Talissa's earpiece as I run on. Slow them down. You have to slow them down. Talissa heard the transmission from the American. She could tell from the desperate tone of his voice and the exertion that she hears along with it that he was doing his best to get to her, and she was certain she would die if he did not. Already she could see a large square that ended at the main street of the old town, just a few blocks below her. And the gate that led out the eastern side of the walled pedestrian-only space was just to the right on the far side. She imagined there would be a car waiting out there for her, and she'd be in it in a couple of minutes unless she did something to slow them down more until the American could arrive. The two men who had ventured off to check out the man running a couple of blocks over were still gone, but the other 6 men surrounded her, and they jostled her when she tried to slow again. She knew she needed to do something, so she tried the only thing she could think of. On her next step down, she purposefully turned her ankle and fell onto the cobblestones, shouting in pain. "My leg!" She spoke for Harry's benefit, letting him know that she was trying to delay her kidnappers. She didn't know if it would be enough, but it was all she could think of. One of the men grabbed her, pulled her upright while shouting at her in his native tongue. She knew almost instantly he was Albanian. He then switched to English. "Walk!" She took a step and then started to collapse again, as if she really had injured herself, but 2 of the men lifted her off the ground and began all but carrying her with their hands under her shoulders.
"Put me down! Let go!" she shouted.
this time to let Harry know her plan had bought her a little time, as the men carrying her would be forced to move slower now, and the others surrounding her would be forced to wait for them. I hear Talissa while I'm in midair, making the desperate kicking leap over the first of the two north-south stared passageways between me and her. I land on the roof to the west, my hands and my feet striking the tile, and then I climb up, running diagonally along the pitched surface so that I am still heading in the right direction to get to the woman, or even to get back in front of her. A few seconds later, I make the crest of the roof, then run down the other side, picking up speed, and I launch myself off again, then land again, one block over. Unless the Albanians have changed direction, they should be three stories down on the other side of the roof I'm now on, so I move more quietly. At the peak, I lower to my butt and crab walk down towards the edge, then look over the side. A group of six men surround the Europol analyst directly below me, and they are only 25 yards away from entering the large square with the fountain where I first saw the police surveilling Talissa earlier in the evening. They are moving at a reasonable pace, but I can tell the girl is making things difficult for them. Still, they will be through the square and out the eastern gate in under 2 minutes at their current speed, so there's no time for me to focus on hashing out a brilliant plan. I start to reach for my pistol, but stop when I recognize it will be too dangerous for Talissa if I fire into the group from here. Nope. I've got to get my ass down on top of them, where I can take them on up close. I see multiple sets of clotheslines on the building outside the windows on the other side of the passage, one floor down from my position. Towels and clothing hang from them, and the line is about 15 feet long before it loops into a pulley and then doubles back, making it 30 feet in all. An idea forms quickly, and I turn and head higher on the roof, yanking on gloves as I go. I then turn around, facing the passage. I say, "Talissa, count silently to five, then pull away from the men and run. Scream and shout while you do it. You have to do this for me in 5 seconds. I don't expect a response from her. I can only pray she complies. After a quick breath to ready myself, I begin running down the roof as fast as I can, counting as I go. I leap off the building, kicking my legs as I drop down, and I cover the entire passageway with my bound. I hear Talissa scream below and to my left just as I crash into the clothesline affixed to the metal bars and pulley system, running alongside two second-story windows. As I hit, both of my gloved hands grab onto a towel hanging there and the line under it, and, as expected, the clothesline absorbs the majority of my momentum, but my weight causes the pulley system to snap off the wall behind me. Hanging on with both hands now, I begin swinging down alongside the building towards the backs of the seven people dead ahead, knowing good and well there isn't enough clothesline to get me all the way down to the stairs, and the other pulley bar is going to snap right off once I swing down, and it's forced to endure my momentum and body weight. I'm along for the ride now, but soon I'll be flying on my own. I wrap the line around my right hand so I don't fall. The towel and gloves keep it from ripping my hand to shreds, but even hanging on as tightly as I can, I feel the towel slide down, and I know I won't be able to hang on for long. I am making noise, the pulleys sticking out from the wall above bend and creak, and my backpack scuffs the stone wall before I swing out farther away from the building. But everyone below me is shouting as one as they lunge for their prisoner, who herself is screaming and shouting. She doesn't manage to get very far before they grab her, but she does manage to cause an excellent distraction. And if these motherfuckers think she is distracting, just wait till they get a load of me. As the line whips me down to the lowest point, I unwrap my hand, still 10 or 12 feet in the air and arcing through the dark, and I shoot forward with all the momentum of my long swing. Landing on the cobblestones or steps would be painful at best, but I have no plans to hit the ground. I'm instead aiming for that cluster of people right in front of me. I fly out of the night air towards the backs of the tight group, and I slam into them from behind like they're bowling pins. I know Talissa is in this crowd, and I'm sure I'm knocking her stupid like all the others, but when you are fighting 6 versus 1, a little collateral damage is difficult to avoid. Everyone falls hard, slamming into one another and then hitting the ground, bodies tumbling out into the northern edge of the square. Talissa ends up on the bottom of the pile, but I manage to roll over it all and am propelled up to my feet beyond the rest of them. I spin back around while drawing my weapon, and I aim at the first target I see, an Albanian in a black tracksuit on his knees right in front of me. I fire twice into his chest at 8 feet, shift aim, then fire once into the face of a man still on his back 10 feet beyond. The noise from the shots pounds off stone all around us. A third man, this one also up to his knees, pulls his pistol and spins towards the fire, but I shoot him twice center mass, then shift my weapon to the left to drop another man, who has risen to a crouch and is just now reaching for his waistband. But before I can press the trigger, another shooter opens up to my left. The boom of a pistol is close, and a shower of sparks blasts off the awning of a cafe just behind me. Whoever is firing is the larger threat now, so I drop to one knee and aim up the east-west street where the noise is coming from, scanning for a target. I'm sure it's the two men who peeled off from the group to come after me, but they must be behind some cover because I can't see them anywhere. While this is going on, I know the men closer to me, the three still alive, are all pulling their guns, so I spin around to the window of a cafe and dive through. Glass shatters, and I crash to the ground inside, roll behind the wall, and reload my weapon. Fresh incoming fire breaks out the rest of the glass in my window as well as other windows to my right, and from the sounds, I can tell there are 4 or 5 guns targeting my position now. All I can do is hunker down and try to ride this out. After 10 seconds, the gunfire stops. I chance a look out the lower corner of the window, and I see 2 men dragging Talissa towards the Plotzi gate on the eastern side of the old town. But when I lean out with my weapon to aim at them, I immediately catch fire from the 2 or 3 positions. I fall flat to the floor underneath the window as dust, bits of stone, and shards of glass fall over me. I'm pinned down here, so I can't go forward, but I sure as shit can run out the back of this cafe, and from there I can head to the west. That will, eventually, get me out through the western pile gate of the old town, near where my car is parked. It means losing sight of Talissa, but at this point, that's going to happen anyway. I climb to my feet and run through the restaurant, and as I do, I shout over a barrage of gunfire from out in the square, hoping she can still hear me in her earpiece. "I'm going for the car! You need to find a way to tell me about the vehicle they put you in. Be clever, Talissa, or else they'll figure out you're tipping someone off." I hear her speak a single word in a tearful voice. "Please." But I don't know if that was for me or for them. I feel helpless right now as I run in the opposite direction, but I tell myself I'm going to get this shit back under control on the road. 21. I'm still a minute away from my car. My right knee and right elbow are throbbing for some reason, and my lungs are screaming from the all-out exertion of my sprint, when I hear the side door of a van slide open through my commo link. Breathlessly, I say, "It's a van. I hear that. I just need to know the color. Then I need to know which direction you're traveling. Do it carefully." I hear no reply, only the sounds of Talissa being placed in the vehicle roughly, men all around her speaking in a foreign language, and then the sound of the van door sliding shut. The engine was already running, obviously, because screeching tires come next. I'm climbing into the Vauxhall when I finally hear Talissa's voice.
Who are you people? I see your black hair, your black beards. Are you Turkish? Moroccan?"
"A black van." I nod and softly say, "Black van, got it, good job. Now be subtle. Tell me the direction."
"Where are we going?" she asks.
"Be quiet,"
a man shouts in English.
"To the Hilton? I see the Hilton. Are we going to the..."
"Be quiet!"
I look down at my phone's GPS, move the map around, and find the Hilton Hotel just west of Old Town. This is good news, as I am to the west of her, or at least I was when her van began moving. They could be right on top of me by now, since a minute or two has passed since then. I launch the 4-door out of the parking lot, jack the wheel hard to the left, and drive off, slowing only as I pass oncoming police vehicles responding to the sound of gunfire in the old town. They pay no attention to me, and soon I'm flooring it again, scanning each intersection to my left and right, desperately trying to find a black van. And it doesn't take long. Other than the oncoming first responders, there is little traffic out this time of night, so when I turn onto Anitza Boskovic, I see headlights behind me approaching fast. I slow to match the speed limit, and soon a black van rushes by me on my left, then makes a left turn at an intersection. I continue straight, not wanting to get too close behind it, and then I one-hand my steering wheel while I hold the phone up to check the GPS, unsure how to link back up with my target vehicle. All the while, I keep speaking softly into Talissa's ear. I see you. I'm right here with you. Don't worry. There's a lot to worry about. I'm worried as shit, as a matter of fact, but keeping her as calm as possible seems like a good idea to me right now. I see the van a minute later, one block south of me and still heading to the west along the Adriatic coast and farther from the old town. It is speeding, almost recklessly, which tells me that long gone are the Albanians' mission discipline and the swagger I saw in their demeanor when they approached Talissa's building. The fact that several of their number are now lying dead on the cobblestones a couple of kilometers behind us has caused them to doubt themselves. So while shooting those guys thinned out the herd and was the right call for me to make, the assholes remaining are only going to be more dangerous to the woman from Europol. I'm still forming a plan as I turn to head towards the road they're on, and still working on it when I fall in to follow them, a couple hundred yards behind. Traffic is light at 2-something in the morning, and I realize I may have a tough time remaining covert if they start driving around on random streets, trying to see if they've picked up a tail. I also realize I may not get a better opportunity than I have now. By my count, there were 8 men involved with Talissa's capture. At least 3 are dead or wounded, and I don't think the 2 who engaged me from the east-west street would have had time to make it to the van before it drove off, so they are somewhere behind us, probably securing transportation for themselves. Assuming the snatch team left a driver in the van, which would have been the prudent move, then there are probably 4 men around Talissa now, up ahead of me. That's bad, but it could be worse. And it will probably get worse, because wherever the hell they are going, one thing's for sure. There won't be fewer than 4 around her when they get there. Plus, now I have them close together. They are close to Talissa as well, which is suboptimal. But I'm a guy who takes the best shot possible and doesn't wait for the perfect shot. I floor the Vox Hall as soon as I decide on a plan. I'm going to take this van down and all the opposition in it, now, before they get to their destination. It takes me a full minute to arrive to within 2 car lengths behind them, and now we are on a winding road heading northwest, with the moonlit sea off to our left. I cinch my seatbelt tighter, put my hand on the gun on my hip for reassurance, and then speak to Talissa. I'm right behind you. I need you to hold on to something, anything. I'm going to wreck the vehicle you're in, and it's going to be bad. But I have to do it. She immediately replies to me, right in front of the Albanians, with utter dread in her voice.
What? No, no, please, no!
Stop talking, a man shouts, and then she screams in surprise and pain as if she's just been struck. I say, it's your best chance, Talissa. You have to trust me. When the vehicle loses control, I want you to put your head in your lap and keep holding on till it comes to a stop. When it does, lie perfectly still, covering your head as best you can. I'll get you out of the van, don't worry. Just ride out the crash, and this will all be over.
Oh God, no, please, she says.
And I imagine the Albanians are starting to wonder who the hell she's talking to. Flooring it now, I say, come on, Gentry, you got this. I'm going to attempt a pit maneuver, a pursuit intervention technique, a standard tactic used by law enforcement around the globe to stop a vehicle, much better than shooting out tires or some bullshit like that. That said, despite my comforting words to my Romanian partner, I imagine this is going to suck for everyone involved. Me, the Albanians, and Talissa. Pitting is a pretty safe trick if done correctly, but pitting a van, even if executed perfectly, is almost always a terrible idea, because the high center of gravity of the van almost ensures it will end up tipping, or worse, flipping. But the threshold of what I think is acceptable risk for Talissa is rising by the minute as she gets closer and closer to the moment I lose her and the bad guys have her all to themselves. Flipping this van might break some bones in the Europol analyst, but I tell myself that if I were her, I'd rather suffer a violent car crash than torture followed by a point-blank gunshot to the back of the head. It's all relative, I guess. There is a counter to the pit maneuver the targeted driver can implement, but I'm doubting this Albanian gangster will be well-versed in high-level defensive driving. But even if he does, there is also a counter-counter-pit maneuver that not many people know. I know it because the CIA taught me everything they could about hurting people and breaking things, and I've picked up even more on the subject since officially leaving the agency. The CIA taught me everything they knew then, but they didn't teach me everything I know now. If the Albanian driver tries to counter my pit, he'll fail, and he'll wreck out just the same. Come on, gentry, I repeat. You got this. I can hear the Albanians shouting at one another through the earpiece. They are anxious and frantic, probably because they now notice that the car trailing behind them is coming up their ass. On the right side of me, a row of large houses is all but hidden behind stone walls and heavy foliage, and on the left it's mostly just trees, with the sea beyond. There's a wide sidewalk running along next to the road here, making the space for me to work in a little bit larger than just a two-lane road. This isn't the perfect place for a pit, but it's the best I'm going to get. I decide to go for it, and I move into the left lane as if I'm about to pass. The driver isn't an idiot. He knows the headlights that came racing up from behind him at 2:30 a.m. are attached to a vehicle that poses a threat. He jerks his wheel violently to the left, squeezing me out. Shit. I slow a little, fake an attempt to approach on the right, and the van bites on this. He pulls hard to the right, and I think I've got an opportunity to get back to his left, but right then, gunfire booms out of the van's rear window, and instantly my windshield spiderwebs. These fuckers aren't messing around. Put your head down, Talissa, and keep it there. I've got to make this happen before one of their rounds hits me in the fucking forehead, so I accelerate till the nose of my four-door is just past the left rear bumper of the van. Then I carefully turn the wheel to the right, nudging in. I make contact. It's not much, but it's sufficient, because it pops the rear end of the van to the right just enough to cause the tires to lose traction and the driver to lose control of the vehicle. The nose of the van veers sharply to the left, and I keep my rightward steer going, even after I've broken contact, so I can get out of the way of what's about to happen. What happens is a lot more violent than I'd hoped for, considering my aim here was to protect one of the people inside the van. The big top-heavy vehicle turns 90 degrees to the road on squealing and smoking tires, and immediately tips over at speed. As I slam on my brakes, I look in my driver's side mirror and see the black van crash onto its right side. The rear door flies open with the impact, and a body ejects onto the street. I can't tell if it's male or female. Poor Talissa, I think. First, I came slamming down from the sky, knocking her to the cobblestones and a pile of men, and now I've wrecked her out in a brutal crash. I'm leaping out of the Vauxhall before the last of the debris from the crash has even rained back to earth. Drawing my pistol, I actuate my weapon light under the barrel, shining it on the scene. The person ejected is a man. He doesn't look as badly injured as I expected him to be, but I fix that immediately by firing twice into his right side as he tries to rise to his feet. He spins away from me and ends up dead on his back in the street, arms and legs splayed. I move around to the front of the vehicle, look through the cracked windshield, and see the driver and the man in the front passenger seat lying on top of each other. They are moving, but I don't fire, because I can't see Talissa. She might be on the wall of the van behind them, so I run around to the back, crouch down, and enter there. My light reflects off dust and smoke in the air, but through it all I see an arm wildly waving a stainless semi-auto pistol my way. The gun snaps, earth-shattering in the small space, and I return fire into the face of the figure holding it, unsure whether I've been shot. I don't feel any impact, but I keep firing till the stainless steel pistol falls away. Only when it does so do I see that this is one of the bearded men. He's lying on top of Talissa in the second row. She is screaming bloody murder, thank God. And now that I know where she is, I move into the van and put my hand on her head to hold her down against the closed sliding door resting on the street. When she's out of my line of fire, I open up on the men in the front seat, dumping a dozen rounds from my Glock into them. Are you hurt? I shout now as I reload, because my ears are ringing from the gunfire in the closed-in space, and I know the Romanian woman's virgin ears will be faring much worse. She shouts back at me.
I don't know! This man is on top of me and—
Hang on!
I pull on Talissa because I can't get over the seat to get the dead guy off her. It's hard work getting her turned around and over the seat back, but finally she is able to crawl out under her own power. Her face is scratched and bruised, and her eyes show mild shock, but she could be a hell of a lot worse, so I count my blessings. We stand amid the wreckage under a street lamp. I feel all over my body to double-check that I didn't catch a bullet. I can't find anything but sore spots, and painful bruising is a lot better than being ventilated by gunfire. Another car has stopped behind us, and I hear barking dogs and shouting humans in the yards of the homes on our right. I've holstered my weapon under my t-shirt, I'm covered with cuts and scrapes and filth from all the scrambling and fighting I've been doing over the past half hour. So to the people here, I look just like another car crash victim. But we can't play this off like a simple traffic accident, since no one for a quarter mile in any direction could have missed the sound of all the shooting. I help Talissa along, ignoring the young man who climbs out of the tiny Nissan behind us. Then we get into the Vauxhall. Seconds later, I've reversed direction and am heading back to the east, moving at a reasonable speed. Flashing lights approach, so I pull into a driveway, as the bullet holes in my windshield are easy to see, even at night. Once the first responders have continued on to the west, I'm back on the road, and my right hand reaches out to feel over Talissa's body. It's called a blood sweep, a quick way to find an injury on someone who may not even be aware they are injured because of the effects of adrenaline. You have to put your hand everywhere to be sure, and I do this without thinking. It's a common practice in my world, but to the uninitiated, I imagine it feels a little off. Instantly, she recoils and smacks my hand away.
What are you doing?
I pull my hand back to the steering wheel. Sorry, it's a thing we do.
What? Who does that? No one does that!
I let it go. Check yourself. Are you bleeding? Are you hurt? Coming out of her anger and shock, she does as I ask. After a moment, she says,
I don't think I'm badly injured, but I hit my head when we crashed.
Rubbing her upper arm, she says,
my shoulder hurts, but I think I'm okay.
I know from experience that if her head and shoulder hurt now, they're going to be killing her in about 12 hours, but I don't mention this. I have to find out if she learned anything at all in the few minutes she was in captivity. I don't expect to find out much, but I have no idea how else to continue my pursuit of the kidnapped women without some sort of new intelligence. But before I can speak, she turns to me.
Thank you.
This I don't expect. Sure. I thought you'd be pissed.
Pissed? I haven't been drinking. Have you?
Mad, angry, I clarify. Knowing she probably learned British English, so she thought I was telling her I thought she was drunk when I pulled her out of the van.
Why would I be mad?
She asks now. I don't know, I guess because I used you as bait and almost got you killed. She shook her head.
You saved my life. I put yours in danger by not trusting you on the rope, and still you came for me. Thank you.
I say, I think you are drunk. She looks me over a moment.
Maybe you didn't do it for me. Maybe you did it for the women you are trying to save. But still, thank you.
She reaches out and squeezes my forearm, then retracts her hand and puts it back in her lap. I ask, did the men say where they were taking you?
Not to me, no. But they did say something.
What do you mean?
Romanian is a romance language. Albanian is not. But both are from the Balkan Sprachbund.
She's a smart woman. I'm lost already. And she sees it in my face, apparently.
I can't speak Albanian, not at all, but I can understand some words and phrases.
And they spoke openly in front of you?
Yeah.
Not very professional of them, I say. In fact, we can't trust it. It could have been disinformation. She picks some grit from the car crash out of the back of her arm, wipes a little blood off her hand onto her jeans.
They were very agitated after you showed up, for good reason. I don't think they were thinking about being professional or trying to deceive me when they left the old town. They were all screaming at one another. At me, too.
Yeah, I heard. What did they say?
I heard the driver say something about a boat.
A boat?
Yes. He definitely said a boat, and then he said something strange. He said very clearly, next to the president.
The president?
Yes, I'm sure of it.
The president of Croatia?
I have no idea what he was referring to.
I pull hard to the side of the road and slam on the brakes. Talissa grabs the dashboard to keep from being propelled forward.
Why are we stopping?
I don't answer. Instead, I lift my phone and look at the GPS, move the map back farther west in the direction the van was headed. After a few seconds, I find what I'm looking for. The Valimar Dubrovnik President Hotel on the tip of the peninsula. 15 minutes from here. Talissa looks out the window at the darkness, then back to me.
That must be it. Let's go then.
I grab my pack out of the back seat, then fish through it a moment. Pulling out her phone and her pistol, I hand both items back to her.
What is happening?
I'm going on alone. We will stay in communication with each other. We're lucky you survived tonight. I'm not pushing it again.
But my sister...
You can do more to help your sister by supporting me than you can running around with me.
You are just trying to get rid of me.
She's right, but I don't admit it. Not at all. If I find that boat they're talking about, I'm going to need to follow it. I'm also going to need to know about the owner of it, where it might be going, that sort of thing. After a moment, she nods.
I can help with that.
I know you can. Keep that phone on. I've got the number programmed into an app on mine that will keep me untraceable, but you will be able to reach me when you need to.
Okay.
She seems unsure, but right now I just want her out of danger. I add, also, you may not know it yet, but you are going to be very sore tomorrow.
I'll be fine.
Not tomorrow, you won't. She climbs out of the car and I follow her, then walk over to a pair of scooters parked along the street next to the hotel. Both are locked, but I pull my pick set and quickly free them both. One is a Gilera Stalker, a little 50cc two-person two-wheeler, and the other is a Derby Boulevard, a more powerful scooter with a 150cc engine.
Where do I go?
I don't really have an answer for this. Just get out of town, find a little suburb, sit tight, wait for instructions from me.
That's it?
I shrug. Pick up some ice, painkillers, bandages, and antibiotic ointment, I add. Trust me. It takes me a few minutes to hotwire both scooters, and soon she is heading east, and I'm heading west, looking for a boat next to the President Hotel. It's not much to go on, but it's all I've salvaged out of one hell of a shitty night. So I do my best to think positively, as the aches and pains from all my activity continue to make their presence known across my body. 22. Maya was well into her second night in the bombed-out warehouse with the rest of the women and girls. It was a warm evening, but the breeze off the water coming through the blast holes in the walls and the blown-in windows made it bearable. Bedding had been brought in by the guards, and there was plenty of room to lie down on the dusty concrete floor. Maya now lay with her head on a little pillow, her eyes tired and bleary from the stress, and she looked around the room, which was difficult with the intermittent moonlight. The female captives around her lay on blankets and mats. Most slept, but a few, like Maya herself, tossed and turned. She heard a vehicle pull up and come to a stop outside, and then she heard car doors opening and closing. The three Albanian guards sitting around the room stiffened up, and then the scuffle of what sounded like a dozen pairs of shoes echoed up the ruined staircase. She sat up, as did many of the girls around her. She couldn't make out the faces of the men who appeared out of the stairwell. Some seemed to be more of the group who had taken over from the Serbians, and they all carried rifles over their shoulders. But there were also four or five silhouettes that didn't match any of the men she'd remembered seeing since arriving here. A tall and fit man with short hair and a clean-shaven face passed through a shaft of moonlight, looking over the women, but Maya didn't get a good look at him before he moved on towards a back wall. Others followed behind him, and she could see white faces, serious eyes, and well-made but casual clothing. She saw no weapons, but the men moved across the big dark space with true authority. These guys were in charge, not the guards. Maya wondered if this meant they would be leaving again soon. She knew she was being smuggled and trafficked for the purposes of sex, but she had no idea where she was going or who she would be made to serve when she got there. Not that it mattered. Her life was over. She held no hope for rescue or escape. Maya looked over the new arrivals and focused again on the tall, bald man, now in the darkened corner. The light was insufficient to reveal any of his facial features, but something about his gait, his posture, and perhaps even his dark aura reminded her of someone she had met before. Jaco Verduren stood in the darkness of the open third story of the ruined building, inspecting the condition of the women here. Normally, he didn't come personally to any of the safe houses in the pipeline. But this warehouse was the closest point to Old Town Dubrovnik, where the Albanians could take their prisoner, so when he was told upon landing that a team had picked up the Europol woman and was bringing her back here, Jaco and his nine men came directly. He would interrogate her to find out where she gained her intel on the consortium and, more importantly to him, he'd find out where Court Gentry was and what he was doing. Once he had this information, he would leave. The Albanians would take the prisoner and kill her, and then they would help guard the merchandise until 5 a.m. when the shipment would be moved to their transport to market. Looking around, Verduren realized this wasn't the right location for an interrogation, but he was not surprised the Albanians didn't know any better. He wasn't going to beat and torture the woman in front of the merchandise. That would be bad for morale. And even if he took her down to another floor of the building, or did it outside in the back of a car, the sound of her screams would carry in these cavernous spaces and along the wide-open shoreline. He was still thinking of this, trying to figure out where he could relocate the woman for a proper grilling, when the leader of the Albanian cell took a call on the other side of the room. The South African couldn't understand the words, but the tone made clear the Albanian was concerned, then confused, then angry, then scared. Verduren just watched him, his hands on his hips, and he wondered how fucking bad this news could possibly be. The cell leader ended his call and put his phone in his pocket, then walked over to Verduren. The two stepped farther away from the captives so they weren't in earshot, and Jaco prepared himself to receive this obviously bad news.
What happened? There has been an attack in the old town, then again on the road 15 minutes east of here. My men are dead, and the woman escaped.
Verduren leaned back against the wall. This was bad news for the pipeline and for the consortium, but he couldn't help but marvel at his target's ability to eliminate anyone in the way of his objective.
Gentry, he said,
and the Albanian took it as a question.
I do not know. No witnesses.
Verduren was already pulling his phone to make a call, but he lowered it as he spoke to the leader of the gangsters watching over the women.
Get these shots ready to go. I'm taking them right now.
The Albanian didn't know the South African slang word for whore, but he understood its use in context. He shook his head.
We have to make the transfer at 5 a.m. It's when the police in the neighborhood switch shifts, and the new cops work for the pipeline. It's only 3 a.m. now. The cops patrolling the neighborhood out there aren't under our control. Are you duff? You've lost how many tonight? 6. Yeah. Obviously, mate, your men don't have the skills to deal with this adversary, do they?
The bearded man shook his head adamantly.
No, it's not one man. Your intelligence is wrong. It can't be one man. It is one man doing the killing, and he's the best there is. You. You lot?
Verduren looked around the room at the gaggle of armored men.
Not the best. We're doing the fucking transfer now. If the cops get in the way, kill them.
He tapped the button on his phone and broadcast into the earpieces of all nine of his men positioned around the property.
Lion actual to all lions. Our target is still out there. And still active. Last seen 15 minutes east of this pause. I'm calling the boat to have the tender brought in now. Will probably take 10 to 20 minutes. I want 2 long rifles on the roof, scanning east and west. I want 2 men down at the dock, eyes open on the water. 4 more men spread out on the east side of the property watching the hill. Lutz and I will escort the women down, 8 at a time, but only when the tender shows up ready to take them. I'll have this local crew spread out farther on the property, but don't leave security up to them. You know the operator we're up against. We don't know what his game is, but if he is aware of this location, you can bet he will be here. Be ready.
Verduren tapped his phone and placed another call, then said,
It's Lion. We've got to move up the delivery. A pause. Right bloody now! I want that Zodiac in the water and that throttle opened up. Be at the dock in 10 minutes.
Dropping his phone in his pocket, the South African pulled his Sig Sauer P226 from its holster under his jacket, thumbed off the safety, and jammed it back into place on his hip. He stepped to an open window and looked out at the night. The water was off to his right, and in front of him was the glow of the Valimar Dubrovnik President Hotel at the bottom of a hill near the coastline and brightly lit, even at 3 in the morning. But between the hotel grounds and his position, also near the bottom of the hill, was roughly 15 meters of broken building foundations, mostly hidden in tall seagrasses and well enshrouded in darkness. And higher on the hill, above the hotel, was another resort property, full of green spaces, a roof with a good vantage point on this ruined building, and a road in front of it lined with parked cars. Next to this was an apartment building still under construction, and farther up the hill were more apartments, well lit but with a good line of sight on this poorly located safe house the Albanians chose. There were 1,000 places in sight for a man of great skill to hide himself in an overwatch position, and Verdun couldn't help the prickly sensation that came with the worry that the gray man had eyes on him right now. He turned away from the view, facing the women and girls. In a calm voice, certainly calmer than he felt, he said,
"We will all be leaving in 15 minutes. You be good girls, and this will go smoothly."
His voice lowered, turning ominous.
"But if you try anything, run, scream, fight, resist, if you try anything, I'll punish you myself. Then I'll feed you to the sharks."
Maya sat in the middle of the room, staring at the silhouette of the man who was obviously in charge here, and her heart pounded. Not because of the threat the South African had just made, not because of his dark tone, and not because of the gun he'd just revealed and then put away. These reasons were not why her lower back seized with terror, the hairs on her arms stood up, and she thought she might be sick. She felt the tremors of terror because, even though she could not see the man's face, she knew exactly who he was. She recognized his voice, and suddenly things began to fall into place in her mind. But no comfort came with this newfound understanding. On the contrary, now she was even more certain she'd never, ever go home again. The girl the captors had been calling Maya since the day she was taken was actually named Roxana Vaduva. She was Romanian, 23 years old, and a university student in Bucharest, majoring in the performing arts. But none of that, not even her name, applied to her anymore, now that she'd heard the South African speak. She was certain she'd never be called Roxana again. She'd never go home to Romania again. She'd never live till her next birthday. And of course, she would never go back to school. She knew what was happening now. It all made perfect sense. Roxana had recognized the big South African the instant she heard his voice in the dark, bomb-shattered warehouse in Dubrovnik, because she had first met him in a nightclub a few weeks earlier when her sister, an investigator from Europol, sent her in to meet some rich bankers in order to help her with a case. The South African had been called John and had been at the American Tom's side each of the 4 times she met him during the week she was in Bucharest. John had never conversed with Roxana directly, but he had sat close by, spoke often with Tom's bodyguard, local mob guys, and the employees of the nightclub. Roxana had asked Tom what John's role was, shouting the question into his ear during especially loud techno music, but Tom had simply explained that the man was a subordinate from South Africa, and they were on the business trip together. Roxana had wondered about the man after this. The bodyguard had been introduced as Sean. He was American, also. He seemed laid back, especially compared to the bald South African. She'd even caught him drinking a couple of shots of vodka when his boss wasn't looking. But Tom was the most charming of them all. The minute she'd approached his table, he'd asked her to sit next to him. He'd poured her Dom Perignon and regaled her with stories about his homes in exotic locations around the world. She'd been cool and standoffish with the American, despite his instant, obvious fascination with her. Roxana was both a talented actress as well as a confident flirt who knew how to attract men. She didn't sleep around, but wasn't above getting a guy to buy her a drink in a bar by flashing a couple of glances his way. She knew how to play a role. She'd performed in theater in Bucharest and Timișoara since grade school, and had even done some commercial work for everything from bottled water to makeup to the Romanian car manufacturer Dacia. She knew how to sell herself, and she laid the push-pull on thick with Tom, because she saw this as an opportunity to gain the respect of her older, aloof, and dismissive sister. Then, on their fourth meeting together, Tom had tried to rape her. Roxana had run away, knowing she'd failed to gain anything useful for her sister, but glad the affair was behind her. Until the previous week, when she was drugged while out with her friends and kidnapped by a cab driver, then taken to a cellar somewhere in Bucharest. Since that evening, she'd felt the panic and desperation, but only tonight did she know, without reservation, that she would not survive. She'd been cruel to Tom. He'd gotten angrier and angrier each night that she'd spurned his sexual advances, and then she'd fought with him when he tried to overpower her. Her sister had insisted he was just some kind of banker, but if he was, in fact, involved in this human trafficking ring, she had no doubts that he could now easily get his revenge. These were incredibly powerful men in charge of this entire operation, and they could make a young Romanian college student disappear with no effort at all. Her mind weighed her options, and she considered killing herself. All she had to do was stand up and throw herself out the huge, painless window 10 meters to her left, just leap over the little broken wall and fall to her death. Quick and easy. But she didn't. She didn't understand what was holding her back at this point, the desolation she felt knowing that the life she loved was over, to be replaced by a life in hell was absolute. But the truth was that she did not want to die. Not until she took some of these bastards with her. Roxana Vaduva told herself in that moment that although she was going down, she wasn't going down without a fight. Scanning with my binos, I eye the Dubrovnik President Hotel, which looks pretty swanky, but to the right of it I see a large patch of empty darkness by the water. As I do my best to adapt to the low light, forms in the dark begin to take shape. A concrete pad that looks like it could be used as a little dock just a few meters out into the bay, and then the hill rising from the water is covered in tall grasses and brush. An unlit 3-story building rests halfway up the hill to the road, and although it is standing and appears structurally sound, the window glass is gone, and there are several gaping holes in the stone walls. Clearly the building was damaged in the war fought here nearly 30 years ago, and has been left unattended since. It's like this all over the Balkans. Chic tourist areas abut bleak, overgrown warscapes. I saw it in Mostar, and I see it here. The war kicked the shit out of these countries, and even though it ended in the 1990s, there is rubble all around still, evidence of the mayhem from long ago. I'm flat on my belly on the second floor of an apartment building that's being built higher on the hill and next to a well-lit and new-looking complex of apartment buildings with views to the bay. Through my 12-power binoculars, I see several SUVs parked near one of the buildings, along with a telltale faint light in a doorway, a sentry checking his phone, perhaps. Scanning around for a minute more, I identify more men, all armed, kneeling in the brush or prone on the roof of the building. But it's hard to see in the dark, even with the binos. If I had an infrared scanner, I imagine I would find a few more jokers down there in the seagrass. Checking the ones in view again, I recognize an intensity in their posture, an especially alert pace to their head swivels, a weight to their bearing that's hard for sentries to maintain for long. These assholes are looking for something. Not something. Me. The asshole who keeps screwing with their business. I breathe slowly, carefully, trying to minimize any movement at all. If any of these dudes have night vision gear, I can only remain covert if I don't move a muscle and keep my body from being exposed to their lenses. This is obviously the place where the Albanians were heading before I ended them, but I'm surprised by the number of personnel around. If the objective had been to just grab the Europol lady and take her offshore to a waiting boat, as Talissa suspected, then why are there so many people standing around here looking for trouble? I'm still pondering this minutes later when I see a brief flash of light out in the bay. A few seconds later, it flashes again. The sliver of moon above is hidden by clouds at the moment, and I can't make out anything. But then I see a third flash and realize this one came not from the water, but from the concrete dock below the large building. I focus on the area and see a man standing there with a gun and a light. He flashes it again, signaling out to sea. I can't hear the sound of a motor from here, but I feel certain some small craft is approaching. Wanting to take advantage of the temporary moonlight, I shift my focus back to the right towards the hillside, and I make out fresh movement in the dark. A cluster of figures moves away from me, down the hill and towards the water from the darkened building in the direction of the concrete dock. I widen my eyes and zoom in on the group. Instantly, fresh adrenaline begins rushing through me. There are women in the cluster, 7 or 8 of them, and they are all bracketed by men carrying rifles. Someone in front of the pack is using a weak flashlight beam to help everyone navigate the way through the foliage on the hillside and to safely get around the grown-over broken concrete strewn all over the hill, wreckage given off by the building when bombs were dropped on it during Croatia's war with the Bosnian Muslims. The women and girls aren't tied or being held at gunpoint. They're just walking along. Around them, armed men continue shepherding them towards the water. These have to be the women from the farmhouse in Mostar. No. Of course they don't have to be, but I really want them to be. But why are there only 8 women here, if I saw something like 25 in the cellar? I ask myself this question, but the answer comes quickly when I see a rigid hull inflatable Zodiac boat motor up to the platform and a man on board throw a line to the individual with the flashlight. The Zodiac is larger than a dinghy, but only big enough for 10 or so. I understand what is happening. The Albanians are bringing the women down to the shore in groups so that a tender can take them out to a mothership before returning again to shore for the next batch. These are the kidnapped victims from Mostar. I feel certain of it now. I'm happy I found the prisoners, happier still that they are alive, but I don't really know what I can do for them right now. I count something like 10 men in view, dotted over the dark hillside, and imagine there are more I can't see. I, on the other hand, I've got a dirty pistol with a couple of magazines, a knife, a beaten up and exhausted body, and a bad attitude. And that's not going to be enough. No, I can't save the women now. And in this low moment, I wonder if I came all this way just to watch them sail off into oblivion. Shaking the thought from my head, I tell myself that my objective tonight is to find out what boat they board and which direction they sail. I'll figure out the next stage of my operation after that. I scan back out to sea, look over every vessel I can find. A tanker is darkened a mile or so out. Several fishing trawlers are close to shore, moored or anchored in the bay here. There is a well-lit yacht just outside the mouth of the bay, partially hidden from my vantage point by a tiny island a couple hundred yards offshore. I can't even tell how big the vessel is because it's hard to judge distance and size over water, especially at night, but from here it looks massive. I've heard of human smuggling taking place in this part of the world, and the stories often include speedboats that race immigrants across the narrow Adriatic Sea to some town on the eastern coast of Italy, Bari or San Marino being the largest. But this big motor yacht hardly looks sufficiently inconspicuous to traffic sex slaves to the west. Scanning back around the overgrown property while the Zodiac loads up, I focus on the blown-out windows of the building in the center. There are multiple points of light on the top floor now. I take them for flashlights, as the intensity increases and decreases randomly, presumably as the devices are moved around. The remaining women could be held there, but it doesn't really matter, because there's not a damn thing I can do from up here. The first group is placed in the tender along